Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the post-Thanksgiving frenzied shopping sales on Black Friday, which were down over 11%, and get an appraisal of this weekend's demonstrations against Walmart from Josh Bivens, Research and Policy Director at the Economic Policy Institute and author of Everybody Wins Except for Most of Us, What Economics Teaches Us About Globalism. We will discuss Josh's research that finds from 2007 to 2010, median American family wealth declined 38.8%, while the wealth of the Walmart heirs rose 22.1%, making the Walton family fortune equal to the wealth of the bottom 49 million American families. Then, at the one-month mark by which the White House had pledged to fix the healthcare.gov website, we will get an analysis of how the troubled launch of the Affordable Care Act is proceeding and whether public confidence in healthcare reform can be restored in the remaining time left to get the insurance exchanges running. Ron Pollack, the founding executive director of Families USA, who helped prepare the Patients' Bill of Rights that has been enacted in many states, joins us to discuss the status of the website and the prospects ahead for Obamacare. Then finally, with many right-wing bishops alarmed and many left-wing priests encouraged by Pope Francis's latest pronouncements, we will look into what kind of a reformer the new pope might be with Jennifer O'Malley, a Roman Catholic woman priest, and Kenneth Briggs, who writes for the National Catholic Reporter. They join us to examine the tectonic shifts underway in the scandal plague church, whose new leader has made provocative statements of late that are at odds with the rigid and reactionary dogma of his predecessors. And joining us now is Josh Bivens, Research and Policy Director at the Economic Policy Institute. He's the author of Everybody Wins Except for Most of Us, What Economics Teaches Us About Globalism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Josh Bivens.
Thank you for having me.
And Josh, your research has revealed to us the shocking, we know about the disparity in wealth in this country and the growing disparity in wealth in this country, but it is particularly egregious when you consider that the Walton family, the heirs to the Walmart fortune, the six children of the Walmart founder, they are now worth $89.5 billion. Oh, this is in 2010 when you did the research, which is the equivalent to the bottom 41.5% of all U.S. families combined. On this, after the Black Friday sales, et cetera, and Walmart was also open on the Thursdays, on Thanksgiving, which is normally a family holiday, my understanding is that overall Black Friday sales were down 11%, but Walmart are claiming that in spite of the demonstrations, their sales were up. So what do you know about that?
Not a lot, except for what you just said. I mean, we sure don't have sort of a official data on consumer sales overall from the government. We won't have that for a couple of months now to know how the retail sector is doing. And when it comes to individual stores or individual corporations like Walmart, we kind of rely on what they report to the public. I mean, I guess in the end of the year, we can look at their official annual report that they give out to the shareholders, and one imagines they will be pretty honest in that one. But in regards to the numbers they're going to report in the midst of this kind of politically contested Thanksgiving weekend, we don't have any independent check on any of that.
Well, I've seen press reports and pictures of Santa Claus being arrested out here in Ontario, California, demonstrating against Walmart. What's your sense of did the mainstream press cover this adequately or at all? Because obviously Walmart is a big advertiser for both newspapers and television stations.
I think it was a huge leap forward from previous years when there have been sort of more sporadic, but there have been protests against Walmart on the Black Friday weekend. I felt like, you know, and I have a very biased sample of media that I look at in terms of the small number of things, but I feel like it's got much, much more attention this year. I feel like anecdotally talking to just people I know, they're much more aware that there's this campaign to pressure the Walmart Corporation to pay its workers better. So I do feel like the coverage of the whole issue has improved a lot. That said, I'll bet you can go through really wide swaths of the country's media and not get any sense at all that this is a contested issue, based in large part for what you just said. I mean, I think there's going to be some reluctance to make such a large influential corporation angry at coverage. But I will say I'm a little gratified by the extent I feel like that this issue is much better known than it has been in previous years. And I think that's a good thing.
So, Josh Bivens, how, though, does one negotiate between the obvious impulse on the part of Americans to consume, which has been encouraged? I don't know whether you've noticed that already before Thanksgiving, the Christmas advertising started. That feels like an invasion. I don't know if it's an invasion of privacy, but it's certainly an invasion of peace of mind. You don't even get through Thanksgiving now without them bombarding you. I always thought it was that after Thanksgiving, the shopping till you drop mania began. So, is what's happening on the part of all retailers? Have they decided to basically do wall to wall advertising more? Whenever they feel like.
Yeah, and I think this is sort of one of those classic race to the bottoms that we really need to solve sort of with policy and with the collective action issue. In the race to the bottom, it's sort of this. It's the idea that, sometime between roughly Thanksgiving and Christmas, lots and lots of Americans are going to go out and buy a lot of holiday gifts. And retailers know that, and retailers want the biggest slice of that, pie that they can get. And so there's this real race to be the store that opens first and has consumers spend money at their store relative to somebody else's. But if we did something like say, retailers just aren't allowed to be open on Thanksgiving and there's not allowed to be open even on Black Friday, or just did something to sort of take that part of the holidays out of the sort of competitive calculus of all these places, nobody would be worse off. I mean, it's not like I spend extra money because a store opens on Thanksgiving or Black Friday. It's not like the stores overall make less money. It's just clearly that zero-sum game to make sure you claim that customer first. And so I feel like we could, do a lot of good, from my perspective, to just say Thanksgiving is just out of bounds. You just don't get to open your stores. Or even do something like, have a state raise sales taxes really high just for the day of Thanksgiving to say, if you want to open, you're going to pay a price. And I don't think we'd do any damage at all to overall consumer sales. We would just take that sort of destructive part of the zero-sum competition out of the whole calculus. But I think that's what's going on there, is people want to be the first ones to claim consumer dollars in the holiday shopping season.
Now, is there any research, Josh, that indicates whether or not the consumers at Walmart over these frenzied shopping days, where they were open on Thanksgiving and on Black Friday, and because obviously people go to Walmart because the stuff is cheaper, but they don't make the association that the stuff that they buy is cheaper, but at the price of the workers there, the people, the so-called associates that are in the store that people, these customers interact with, these people can't make a living wage. They then in turn depend upon you, the shopper, to subsidize their health care and their food stamps and other public benefits that they require to get because their employers simply don't pay them enough, and that the vast profits that Walmart earns, $17 billion per year, are going to this family of heirs who, if you count them in with the Koch brothers, the fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, and ninth wealthiest Americans are either Kochs or Waltons.
Yeah, I think this is another example of sort of that collective action problem. I mean, you see a lot in sort of opinion surveys that people indicate a willingness to pay a little extra to buy what they buy at these retailers if they could be assured that extra they were paying would actually show up as higher wages and benefits for the workers. But there's no real immediate connection to then saying, so if I don't shop at this place, wages will go up at Walmart, because there is no obvious connection between those two things. And so I think that's where you have the disconnect between people shop at Walmart, even if they don't necessarily approve of the labor practices or the wage and compensation there. And you can't just take the fact that people continue to go through the doors as evidence that they don't care about the labor compensation, or they're even hostile to the movement to get higher wages at these retailers. And the other issue is it may be, you know, you are willing to pay a little extra in order to see the workers at these places get higher wages, but you're not willing to, say, you know, have a lower standard, living standard than your neighbor who is not willing to make that trade-off and go there. Instead, what you need is to have sort of a collective solution, either policy, you know, substantial increase in the minimum wage that helps finance wage increases for a lot of the people who work at these large retailers, or something like that. And so I think that's the thing that solves the apparent contradiction between lots of people still go to these big box retailers, and yet lots of people would still be willing to pay a little more if they could be assured that that little more would show up as higher wages and benefits for the workers who work at those places.
So, Josh Bivens, tell us about your research that finds this extraordinary, you know, we know about the growing disparity in wealth in this country, but clearly the Waltons family are the poster children for this disparity, when you consider that, according to your research, from 2007 to 2010, median American family wealth declined 38.8%, while the wealth of the Walmart heirs rose 22.1%, making the Walton family fortune equal to the wealth of the bottom 49 million American households. It's just shocking when you read that.
It is. I mean, and I think there's a couple things there. I think on the one hand, sort of the family fortune of the Waltons compared to the working conditions of the people who largely staff their stores, you know, it's a symbol of the huge increase in economic inequality. Inequality of wages, incomes, wealth that has characterized the country over the past three decades. And then on the other hand, you know, Walmart is actually a big enough employer at this point. I mean, they're the single biggest private employer in the United States economy. That it goes beyond just symbol. I mean, the sort of labor conditions and sort of the contours of the low-wage labor market across big parts of this country are actually influenced by what the Walmart Corporation decides to do with regards to their workers. For example, it would be very, very hard to undertake, say, a campaign to raise wages at competitors to Walmart unless Walmart's wages actually went up, because the competitors could rightly say, we just can't do that. Walmart is so big, and their wages there are low, and so we'll be undercut unless we can figure out some way to engineer an across-the-board wage increase. So it's not just symbol. It's also the fact that this has become kind of the marginal employer, you know, the one that sort of sets the standards for a huge swath of the retail industry across the country. The other thing I would just add, too, that to me, there's the issue of the number about how many, you know, the Walton family has more wealth than the bottom 40-something million American families combined. The more shocking thing to me is if you even take the median wealth in the United States in 2010, and this is, you know, the typical family. They have more wealth than half of all the people in the United States. They have less wealth than half. It would take about 1.1 million of these typical families to equal the combined net worth of the Walton family in 2010. So a lot of people quibble with the number about, you know, the Walton family has more wealth than the bottom 40 million, because they're like, oh, you've got all these college students who have student debt, but they're going to be fine in 10 years, and so that's not a real number. But it still takes a city's worth of typical American families to add up to that overall wealth number. So, as you say, the sheer magnitude of the disparity between sort of the top 1%, the top 0.1%, and typical Americans is just staggering these days. And in the case of Walmart, it's just incredibly emblematic about how tied up that increase in wealth disparity is with the ability of powerful employers in this country to not give wage increases to the vast majority of their workforce.
But Josh Bivens, it doesn't necessarily make any economic sense, this Walmart model, to be this greedy and have such disregard for your employees. The Costco, for example, pays their employees a living wage with full benefits, and that's a very profitable company. So What is it about the Walton heirs? These, you know, what are they, just greedy rednecks? Why are they the way they are? If you don't have to conduct your businesses this way, you can actually have a decent arrangement with your workers. That's a win-win, as in the case of Costco.
I would say a couple things. I mean, one, I think, you know, you have Walmart and then you have sort of the larger American political economy over the past couple of decades, which is we have given enormous incentives for corporations and very well-placed economic actors to pursue this, you know, call it a low road strategy, this strategy of making sure your profits are high by ensuring that wages of your employees don't rise very fast. You know, if you look at the policy maneuvers we've undertaken for the past three decades, we've allowed the inflation-adjusted value, the minimum wage, to go just get battered for decades at a time by rising inflation without raising it. It is still today far below its historic high that it reached in the late 1960s. We have an economy that's literally twice as productive, producing twice as much per hour on average as we did in the late 1960s, and yet we have a minimum wage that's lower. We've also had policy that has basically not kept the playing field level at all between unions and the employers who are trying to break unions, and we've basically made it very cheap for employers to go the union-busting route by not imposing enough sanctions. And we've also decreased marginal tax rates enormously on very top incomes. And so we've sort of moved, you know, basically changed all the rules of the game over the past three decades to encourage corporations to take the route that Walmart has taken. In some sense, you know, to my mind, you kind of have to explain why companies like Costco have chosen the way they have. They're kind of swimming against the tide. They're kind of ignoring a lot of the incentives and a lot of the easy routes to higher profits, which I think they should be commended for. But it's asking a lot for corporations to ignore all these incentives that we've given them to go the low road. And so to my mind, we have to block the low road. I mean, we have to make sure policy does not make it easy for the Walmarts of the world to operate the way they do and push people to trying to make profits and in a healthy way. So I think it's of those two companies that are often sort of contrasted with each other, Costco is really the outlier. You know, you could say Walmart could do as well by treating their workers better. I'm a little agnostic on that. I think it would be fine for them to do a little bit less well and have their workers do quite a bit better. So I think it's not necessarily the case that you have to explain the behavior of Walmart given the sort of policy incentives we've given over the past couple of decades. You actually have to explain the high road companies.
Well, is there anything, just in closing, Josh Bivens, that the National Labor Relations Boards can do? You know, the Republicans Senate were filibustering appointees to that board going to the mat. So clearly there's an agenda here since the Republicans are so zealous in their defense of billionaires. So what's going on here in terms of, you know, given that we, the taxpayers, have to make up for, you know, the deficit in health care and a living wage that the Walmart employees have because of these disgusting owners of this company and the managers of this company who simply don't want to – they'd like to make it TV commercials calling them associates and having them all smiling for the camera. But the reality is these people can't make a living wage and depend upon the taxpayer for food stamps and health care. So the taxpayer has a stake in this. So is there anything that can be done through the National Labor Relations Board?
I think through them. I also think we need sort of a much broader campaign to raise wages in the United States, you know, and not even just at the low retail end. I mean, if you look over the past couple of decades, you really have to get to the 90th, 95th percentile of wage earners to see people whose hourly wages have actually kept up with the sort of underlying productivity growth in the economy, which is basically the benchmark for what wages could have grown at. We had a period in the late 1990s where wages...
Hello, did we lose this call? Is Josh back? Could you finish your thought, Josh? You got cut off. Sorry.
Yeah, and so, one, we need to get back to very low rates of unemployment sooner rather than later. Nothing boosts bargaining power of workers like low rates of unemployment. Two, we need a higher value of the minimum wage, and we need to make sure it doesn't get battered by inflation over time, so we should index it to something so it is a meaningful labor standard forevermore. And then three, we should make it much easier for willing workers to form unions and force employers to bargain collectively with them. There was the Employee Free Choice Act a couple years ago that was floating around Congress and never went anywhere. It can be something like that, but we've got a majority of American workers who either are in a union or want to be in a union, and yet we have the lowest number on record who actually are bargaining collectively with their employers, and we need something to fill in that gap, and that something is policy that tilts the playing field back to give willing workers a fair chance to organize. And so I think we need to think big about boosting wages and not just relying on, like you say, these public transfer programs to give people decent living standards. We need both. We need the transfers, but we also need workers with the bargaining power that they can actually get some wage increases from their employers.
Well, I appreciate you joining us here because the contrast between there's a broader issue here, and that is the extent to which we still are a democracy, you know, because the wealthy, since Citizens United, can buy our politics, and we clearly have if you've got the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th richest Americans either being a Coke or a Walton, and if you add up their total or their fortune, it's extraordinary. So you see the enormous power they have. If politics for sale, then they've got the game sewn up. So there has to be some countervailing movement here to level the playing field.
That's right. And I think that's, in one way, that is what is so promising about the sort of Walmart campaign, is that it's, because these are kind of abstract issues. When you can talk about we need, you know, a broad-based campaign to raise American wages, their trailing productivity and numbers, and it gets all very abstract pretty quickly. Pointing to a corporation whose owners have this enormous fortune and who their employees interface with Americans all the time and are in such sort of stark economic circumstances, I think that really has a chance to be a catalyst to move these issues to really the front burner of American politics. And so it's a shame that Walmart has the labor practices it has. I think it's really good that there's a real spotlight being shined on them, and it's actually casting this broader, unequal economy we have in very stark relief.
Well, Josh Bivens, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Josh Bivens, who's a research and policy director at the Economic Policy Institute. He's the author of Everybody Wins Except for Most of Us, What Economics Teaches Us About Globalization. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about whether or not the healthcare.gov site is up and running and that Obamacare is going to work in the future.